When Hasdrubal, the Carthaginian commander, threw himself as a suppliant at Scipio's knees, the general, turning to those around him, said, "Look, my friends, how well fortune knows to make an example of inconsiderate men. This is that very Hasdrubal who lately rejected the many kind offers I made him, and said that his native city and her flames were the most splendid obsequies for him. And here he is, with suppliant bows, begging for his life from me, and reposing all his hopes on me." Some of the deserters now came forward to the edge of the roof, and begged the front ranks of the assailants to hold back for a moment. And when Scipio gave this order, they began to abuse Hasdrubal, some of them for having violated his oath, saying that he had often sworn solemnly that he would not desert them, and others for his cowardice and general baseness of spirit. At this moment, his wife, seeing Hasdrubal seated with Scipio in front of the enemy, came out from the crowd of deserters, herself dressed like a great lady, but holding her children, who wore nothing but their smocks, by each hand, and wrapping them in her cloak. At first, she called on Hasdrubal by his name, but when he maintained silence and bent his eyes to the ground, she began by calling on the gods and expressing her deepest thanks to Scipio for sparing, as far as he was concerned, not only herself, but her children. Then, after a short silence, she asked Hasdrubal how, without saying a word to her, he had deserted them all and betaken himself to the Roman general to secure his own safety. How he had thus shamelessly abandoned the state and the citizens who trusted in him and gone over secretly to the enemy. And how he had the face to sit now beside the enemy with suppliant bows in his hands, that enemy to whom he had often boasted that the day would never dawn on which the sun would look on Hasdrubal alive and his city in flames. Turning round to me at once and grasping my hand, Scipio said, "A glorious moment, Polybius, but I have a dread foreboding that some day the same doom will be pronounced on my own country." Zella is a town situated in Pontus, with adequate natural defences considering its position in a plain, for its battlements are reared upon a hill. Here, Pharnaces repaired the ancient works of his father's once prosperous camp, and occupied the position with his entire forces. Caesar pitched his camp 5 miles distant from the enemy, and as he now saw that the valley by which the king's camp was protected would, if its width separated them, equally afford protection to a camp of his own, he ordered materials for a rampart to be carted within the entrenchments. The following night he left camp at the fourth watch with all his legions in light order and the heavy baggage left behind in camp, and surprised the enemy at dawn by capturing that very position where Mithridates once fought his successful action against Triarius. To this spot he ordered the slaves to bring from the camp all the accumulated material for the rampart, so that none of his troops should quit their work of fortification, since the intervening valley which separated the enemy's camp from the emplacements which Caesar had begun was not more than a mile wide. On suddenly observing this situation at dawn, Pharnaces drew up all his forces in front of the camp. Caesar was not deterred from keeping the remainder of his army engaged on the work of fortification, deploying only the front line in front of the palisade. Pharnaces, however, took it into his head to engage. Whether it was the lucky associations of the spot that drove him to this course, or the small number of our troops which, according to his information, were standing to arms, or maybe even it was his confidence in that veteran army of his, which, as his envoys boasted, had fought and conquered upon 22 battlefields. Having decided to engage, he began the descent down the steep ravine. For some little time, Caesar laughed contemptuously at this empty bravado on the part of the king, and at his troops, packed closely on ground which no enemy in his senses would be likely to set foot on, while in the meantime, Pharnaces, with his forces in battle array, proceeded to climb the steep hillside confronting him, at the same steady pace at which he had descended the sheer ravine. Caesar recalled his troops from their work of fortification, ordered them to stand to arms, deployed his legions to meet the attack, and formed a line of battle. And the sudden excitement to which all this gave rise occasioned considerable panic among our troops. Disorganized as our men were, and as yet in no regular formation, the king's chariots armed with scythes threw them into confusion. But these chariots were speedily overwhelmed by a mass of missiles. In their wake came the enemy line. The battle cry was raised, and the conflict joined, our men being greatly helped by the nature of the ground, but above all, by the blessing of the immortal gods. Heavy and bitter hand-to-hand fighting took place, and it was on the right wing, where the veteran 6th Legion was posted, that the first seeds of victory were sown. As the enemy were being thrust back down the slope on this wing, so too, on the left wing and in the center, the entire forces of the king were being crushed. The ease with which they had climbed the uneven ground was now matched by the speed with which, once dislodged from their footing, the unevenness of the ground enabled them to be driven back. Consequently, after sustaining many casualties, some killed, some knocked out by their comrades falling on top of them, those whose nimbleness did enable them to escape, nonetheless threw away their arms. And so, after crossing the valley, they could not make any effective stand from the higher ground, unarmed as they now were. Our men, on the contrary, elated by their victory, did not hesitate to climb the uneven ground and storm the entrenchments. In his Pontic triumph, Caesar displayed among the showpieces of the procession an inscription of but 3 words. I came, I saw, I conquered. Not indicating the events of the war as the others did, but the speed with which it was finished. For now it was that the Roman general came and led his army against Eleazar and those Sicarii who held the fortress Masada together with him. And for the whole country adjoining, he presently gained it and put garrisons into the most proper places of it. He also built a wall quite round the entire fortress, that none of the besieged might easily escape. He also set his men to guard the several parts of it. He also pitched his camp in such an agreeable place as he had chosen for the siege, and at which place the rock belonging to the fortress did make the nearest approach to the neighbouring mountain, which yet was a place of difficulty for getting plenty of provisions. For it was not only food that was to be brought from a great distance, and this with a great deal of pain to those poor Jews who were appointed for that purpose, but water was also to be brought for the camp, because the place afforded no fountain that was near it. Since therefore the Roman commander Sylva had now built a wall on the outside, round about this whole place, as we have said already, and had thereby made a most accurate provision to prevent any of the besieged running away, he undertook the siege itself. Though he found but one single place that would admit the banks he was to raise. For behind that tower, which secured the road that led to the palace and to the top of the hill from the west, there was a certain eminency of the rock, very broad and very prominent, but 300 cubits beneath the highest part of Masada. It was called the White Promontory. Accordingly, he got upon that part of rock and ordered the army to bring earth. And when they fell to that work with alacrity and abundance of them together, The bank was raised and became solid for 200 cubits in height. Yet was not this bank thought sufficiently high for the use of the engines that were to be set upon it, but still another elevated work of great stones compacted together was raised upon the bank. This was 50 cubits both in breadth and height. The other machines that were now got ready were like to those that had been first devised by Vespasian and afterwards by Titus for sieges. There was also a tower made of the height of 60 cubits and all over plated with iron, out of which the Romans threw darts and stones from the engines and soon made those that fought from the walls of the place to retire and would not let them lift up their heads above the works. At the same time, Silva ordered that the great battering ram which he had made to be brought thither and to be set against the wall and to make frequent batteries against it, which, with some difficulty, broke down a part of the wall and quite overthrew it. However, the Sicarii made haste and presently built another wall within that, which should not be liable to the same misfortune from the machines with the other. It was made soft and yielding, and so was capable of avoiding the terrible blows that affected the other. When Silva saw this, he thought it best to endeavor the taking of this wall by setting fire to it. So he gave the order that the soldiers should throw a great number of burning torches upon it. Accordingly, as it was chiefly made of wood, it soon took fire, and when it was once set on fire, its hollowness made that fire spread to a mighty flame. Now, at the very beginning of this fire, a north wind that then blew proved terrible to the Romans, for by bringing the flame downward, it drove it upon them, and they were almost in despair of success, as fearing their machines would be burnt. But after this, on a sudden, the wind changed into the south, as if it were done by divine providence, and blew strongly the contrary way, and carried the flame and drove it against the wall, which was now on fire through its entire thickness. So the Romans, having now assistance from God, returned to their camp with joy and resolved to attack their enemies the very next day. On which occasion they set their watch more carefully that night, lest any of the Jews should run away from them without being discovered. However, neither did Eleazar once think of flying away, nor would he permit anyone else to do so. But when he saw their wall burnt down by the fire, and could not devise no other way of escaping or room for their further courage, and setting before their eyes what the Romans would do to them, their children, and their wives, he consulted about having them all slain. When we marched on from this place, the Persians, since their frequent losses made them dread regular battles with the infantry, laid ambushes and secretly attended us from the high hills on both sides, watching our companies as they marched, so that the soldiers, all day long, neither raised a palisade nor fortified themselves with stakes. And while the flanks were strongly protected and the army, as the nature of the ground made necessary, advanced in square formation, but with the battalions in open order, it was reported to the emperor, who even then unarmed had gone forward to investigate, that the rear guard had suddenly been attacked from behind. Excited by the misfortune, he forgot his coat of mail and merely caught up a shield in the confusion. But as he was hastening to bring aid to those in the rear, he was recalled by another danger, the news that the van which he had just left was just as badly off. While he was hastening to restore order there, without regard to his own peril, a Parthian band of mailed cavalry on another side attacked the centre companies and quickly overflowed the left wing, which gave way since our men could hardly endure the smell and trumpeting of the elephants. But while the emperor rushed hither and thither among the foremost ranks of the combatants, and as the Persians turned in flight, they hacked at their legs and backs and those of the elephants. Julianus, careless of his own safety, shouting and raising his hands, tried to make it clear to the men that the enemy had fled in disorder, and, to rouse them to a still more furious pursuit, rushed boldly into the fight. His guards, who had scattered their alarm, were crying to him from all sides to get clear of the mass of fugitives, as dangerous as the fall of a badly built roof, when suddenly, no one knows when, a cavalryman's spear grazed the skin of his arm, pierced his ribs, and lodged in the lower lobe of his liver. While he was trying to pluck this out with his right hand, he felt that the sinews of his fingers were cut through on both sides by the sharp steel. Then he fell from his horse. All present hastened to the spot. He was taken to the camp and given medical treatment. And soon, as the pain diminished somewhat, he ceased to fear. And fighting with great spirit against death, he called for his arms and his horse, in order by his return to the fight to restore the confidence of his men, and troubling nothing about himself, to show that he was filled with great anxiety for the safety of the others. But since Julianus's strength was not equal to his will, and he was weakened by the great loss of blood, he lay still, having lost all hope for his life, because, on inquiry, he learnt that the place where he had fallen was called Phrygia, for he had heard that it was fate's decree that he should die there. But when the emperor had been taken to his tent, the soldiers, burning with wrath and grief, with incredible vigor, rushed to avenge him, clashing their spears against their shields, resolved even to die if it should be the will of fate. And although the high clouds of dust blinded the eyes, and the burning heat weakened the activity of their limbs, yet as though discharged by the loss of their leader, without sparing themselves, they rushed upon the swords of the enemy. On the other hand, the exulting Persians sent forth such a shower of arrows that they prevented their opponents from seeing the bowmen. Before them slowly marched the elephants, which, with their huge size of body and horrifying crests, struck terror into horses and men. Further off, the trampling of the combatants, the groans of the falling, the panting of the horses, and the ring of arms were heard, until finally both parties were weary of inflicting wounds, and the darkness of night ended the battle. On that day, 50 Persian grandees and satraps fell, besides a great number of common soldiers. While these things were happening in Jebus, a dreadful rumor came from the west. Rome had been besieged, and its citizens had been forced to buy their lives with gold. Then, thus despoiled, they had been besieged again, so as to lose not their substance only, but their lives. My voice sticks in my throat, and as I dictate, sobs choke my utterance. The city, which had taken the whole world itself, was taken. Nay, more, famine was beforehand with the sword, and but few citizens were left to be made captives. In their frenzy, the starving people had recourse to hideous food, and tore each other limb from limb, that they might have flesh to eat. Even the mother did not spare the babe at her breast.